All right, this is a dangerous mission, and we're going to have to go undercover. But in the end, I think it's worth it. We are going to find out what's in that secret sauce by any means necessary. But we're going to have to go deep cover. Do you have your red wig?
The Merkin?
Oh, yeah, I should have told you on what in... You know what? You just be the Hamburglar. You're creepy enough.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Greetings to all the buyers, suppliers, and A1 liars. Welcome to another not-so-undercover episode of Junk Food Cinema here on FilmSchoolRejects.com. This is the weekly cult and exploitation film cast that indulges in pure, uncut fandom without any trace of irony to corrupt the purity of the product. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, way past 5 o'clock shadow at this point, and I am joined by my friend and co-host, novelist/screenwriter, Mr. C. Robert, don't call me Tubbs Cargill.
Yeah, well, you know, we didn't mention this last week, but we've started recording in your man cave.
Literally is a cave.
It is.
There are no windows.
There are no windows. There's these three, like, bright track lights.
Yeah.
Up on one wall, creating this kind of cool, dim atmosphere. We're sitting in big, huge leather recliners with two cup holders.
One
so we can double fist our beers.
Yeah.
And we're surrounded by VHS, DVDs, and a projection system. And this is recording Junk Food Cinema in comfort.
I agree. Yeah. I think this was the right move. This used to be a garage and now it's half converted, and they showed it to, they were like, this is a bedroom. And I was like, no, it's not. No reasonable human being would live out here. There's only one possible use for this room, and it's to be a man cave with a projection screen. And I'm so happy.
I don't know. You could also use it as a halfway decent sex dungeon.
You know what?
It's got a door to the attic.
I am terrified that you're not...
inadequate lighting.
You're not the first person to suggest that to me, and that kind of scares me a little bit. Anyway, just in case you were wondering, yes, you can get all of the back episodes of this show on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/, Junk Food Cinema. And hey, if you happen to be in the Minneapolis, Minnesota area around July 4th weekend, Convergence is coming, and we will be doing a live show for the second year in a row at Convergence, and I am so excited for that.
Yeah, in addition, if you happen to be in the Houston area around the weekend of May 21st, 22nd, Comic Palooza is going on, and I'll be a guest there, and of course, I'll be more than happy to talk anything Junk Food Cinema, movie, or book related.
Sweet. Well, we've been doing a lot of themed months lately, and while that's fun for us, we thought we'd spend a while just gabbing about our favorite cult, forgotten, maligned, and or exploitation films that don't necessarily fall neatly into a theme. That's right, folks. Throw your suit jackets over your neon-colored t-shirts and push your sleeves way up, because today we're talking Miami Vice. Yes, dance. Dance to the Jan Hammer. You dance to it. Oh, yeah. But of course, we're talking about the director's cut of the 2006 Michael Mann film, Miami Vice.
Yeah, well, I mean, Michael Mann's been a part of Miami Vice since the beginning. And this was his cinematic relaunch, or attempt at a cinematic relaunch. Whether or not they planned more movies, or whether they planned just to make the one. Mann, you know, who I believe directed the pilot episode for...
The multi-part pilot episode,
yes,
of Miami Vice.
Which was, for those of you who weren't alive in the 80s or weren't old enough to know in the 80s, this was a huge cultural event. The theme song for Miami Vice was a hit on the radio,
which you heard at the top of the show.
And the soundtrack was a big seller. And in fact, the pilot episode has one of the greatest Phil Collins songs ever in the air tonight.
Which became inextricably tied to this show in the 80s. Yeah.
Yeah. The second greatest drum break of all time. So, so this was one of my picks. Because it was something I was talking about with a listener of the show who's also a great critic in his own right, James Marsh, who had revisited it. And I hadn't actually seen the director's cut, but I loved the movie when it came out. But a lot of people didn't. And so I sat down to rewatch the director's cut and was even more in love with it and just fascinated by its structure and what man had done with it. So I figured it would be a really cool time to sit down and kind of talk about such a cool, weird, quirky little cop procedural.
Yeah, and it's funny because I saw this, I believe, when it was in theaters and didn't think a heck of a lot of it. So I was anxious to give it a second viewing, and I had never seen the director's cut. And, you know, for me, I enjoyed the movie more on the second viewing, but I don't think that a lot of my enjoyment came from the differences in the director's cut. I think this will be interesting to talk about.
Yeah.
What exactly Mann added and what was taken out. And the thing, there are things I think do work a lot better in the director's cut than it, you know, did in the theatrical, but we'll get to that as well. I did not grow up in the 80s. I did, however, have a father who was kind of obsessed with Miami Vice. It was like a huge, huge Miami Vice fan, and it definitely rubbed off. Like, it's fun to, you know, even though I'm kind of below the age line of people that should appreciate the show, to watch this movie a second time and just pick out all the little things that are very, very indelible to the show, and the things that kind of carry over that you don't expect, or the things that you might not recognize as being a carryover from the show. But let's talk a little bit about the basic plot of Miami Vice. Just the who, what, when, where, why, and who else.
Yeah. Well, let's give a little cinema back history for a moment. The show debuted in 84 or 85?
I believe it was 1984.
84. So this is, we've talked about this era quite a bit. So in the early 70s, you had a lot of grit and grime and darkness in cinema. And then Jaws came out in 75, followed up by Star Wars in 77, creating the era of the blockbuster. And so from 77 on, Hollywood had shifted gears from making cinema into making movies. And movies were getting sillier and sillier. And in very good ways. You know, 1984, we're talking about the year that Ghostbusters came out. We're talking about some really, really great, a really great year for geek cinema. But there was a weariness growing within the population, as often happens, that things had gotten too far away from it. People who liked gritty cop dramas, people who, you know, over a decade before had fallen in love with the French Connection and wanted stories about real cops and corruption and the dirtiness of crime, all of a sudden police officers were practically superheroes and doing ridiculous things, to the point that there was even a small cult hit at the time called Super Fuzz, which was an Italian film that we should probably, here comes the alarm, talk about it a later issue.
Yeah, take a drink.
But yeah, I mean, it was one of those things where things were becoming a little over the top, and all of a sudden, here's this show that comes out of nowhere about the grit and grime and underbelly of the Miami narcotics scene. And so the show is the story of these two cops, Crockett and Tubbs, played by...
On the show?
Yes.
Philip Michael Thomas. And, of course, Don Johnson.
Yeah. And who, of course, you know, were really great and became iconic. The dress of the show influenced the look of 2-3 years of the 80s.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
I mean, it was such a huge hit. It was such a cultural milestone. It helped shift the concept of what people wanted in television and cinema into the late 80s, where we saw, you know, Die Hard and the emergence of the gritty realistic action hero, where, you know, for several movies we had Bruce Willis being a normal cop caught in extraordinary situations before he eventually became a superhero who could tap dance on the wings of jet planes.
You know what I think is funny, though, is that in Miami Vice, they were placed into a lot of completely ordinary for cop situations, and they still managed to fuck shit up.
Yes.
That's one of my favorite, like, catches about the show, is that every time somebody was placed into police custody with either Crockett or Tubbs, that person was gonna die. Like, they were the worst police protection you could possibly ask for.
Well, you know, it's interesting because that's what was so cool about the show was these cops were not great cops.
No, not so much.
They were good people, and they tried really hard, and they were really smart and really clever, but they fucked up a lot. In fact, one of the running themes of the show was that Crockett would always fall in love with the wrong woman.
Yes, and that is something that in just a moment we'll talk about carrying over into the movie. What I like about Miami Vice, the movie, is that it reminds me that there is a universe, there is a parallel dimension where Bad Boys 2, as a police film, is done right. As a complete destruction spectacle, it is done right as it is. But as a police film...
Do not profane Bad Boys 2 in my presence. Yeah,
well, anyway... But as a police film, the correct version of Bad Boys 3 is Miami Vice, separated only by 2 years. And you've got Colin Farrell, who is a very interesting, very unusual choice for Sonny Crockett. And then you've got Chris,
really
Jamie Foxx.
A gritty, unshaven actor who sleeps with every woman he meets,
who's Irish. I'm just saying, it's a little bit of an odd choice. And then of course you've got Jamie Foxx, who, by the way. Colin Farrell had to take a pay cut because as they were shooting this, Jamie Foxx won the Oscar for Ray and demanded more money. So
during the
fucking filming of the movie, demanded more money, and Colin Farrell's like, yeah, whatever, I'll take the pay cut. Just film the fucking thing. I don't know if he actually said it like that, but in my head, that's what it sounds like. But yeah, I think it is interesting. You bring these two guys together and you have a very different take on the same material from show to movie. And I'm not sure if that's just because of the time difference, of the huge span of time that has passed since the show has been on the air to the release of the movie, or if Mann is deliberately trying to do something different, even as he's playing in his own sandbox again.
I feel that he's trying to do something different. It's, in fact, it's what I love about this movie, is it is a very different film. It's an experimental action film. And there aren't a lot of those. The thing I love most about this movie is the movie kicks off in media res and never, ever has a traditional first act. Like, it's a movie that opens up in the second act. And
which was something that happened on the show a lot. That's one of the carryovers that I think people don't notice right off the bat. It's like, there are a lot of episodes where you come in the middle of a sting operation that had already been planned.
Yeah, so you're watching for the first 10-15 minutes of this movie, and you're like, I don't know what's going on, except that you're following what's going on. You get the gist of it. You've seen enough cop shows.
There was just no preamble for it.
There's no preamble. There's no being in the office and getting the call and a little bit of exposition. This movie is exposition free for the most part. I mean, everything feels natural in the development of the story. Mm-hmm. Like, it's these guys are on a mission, they're on a sting, and then they get a call from an informant who we don't know, played by John Hawks. The amazing John Hawks, who at this time, you know, nearly 10 years ago, still was a relative unknown, hoofing it in Hollywood. And people, you know, geeks like us were going, oh, dude, it's the guy from Dusk Till Dawn. He's the guy who ran the liquor store. Awesome. And but everyone else was like, who's this guy? And now you look back and you're like, oh, my God, that's Academy Award nominated actor John Hawks. He played Cowboy in Freaked. True story, but...
that is a true story. But that impresses you.
John Hawks is an entire movie. You can't tell he's in it because he's a big cowhead. How can that not be impressive? They get this call and they've got to figure out what the fuck's going on. So all of a sudden they're scrambling. You're seeing these cops in action. We're learning who these guys are right in the middle of all this craziness. And none of it is traditionally set up. And we go right from this into their next big mission. And it is just fantastic how it happens because it's almost like a fever dream. Like, it just flows and keeps going, and there's none of the bullshit, there's none of the traditional screenwriting tropes that you have to have for audiences, which is, I feel, possibly why so many audiences rejected it, because it just doesn't, it feels a little, you know, non-movie-like, and even though it's entirely linear, it never tries to catch you up. It's just like, hey, we're speeding along. You try to keep up like these characters are. And I love that structure, and I love the way it all comes together. And then, of course, on top of that, it's just gritty as fuck.
Yeah. I mean, so in the opening of the film, if we're going to, you know, kind of pepper this conversation with differences between the director's cut and the theatrical cut, the theatrical cut just opens up right in the club. I mean, it opens with the numb encore mashup between Linkin Park and Jay-Z, and everyone's in the club, and you start to meet the players as they're wandering through the room, and then you kind of catch up with them as they're in the middle of this mission. But the beginning of the director's cut has this speedboat chase, which I can kind of understand why it was cut, but I think there's an advantage disadvantage. On the one hand, as we mentioned, after the pilot episodes, the Miami Vice show often dropped us right in the middle of operations without any kind of planning session scene or lead up. So that made more sense show-wise to kind of cut that out. On the other hand, the thing in this movie that feels the most to me like the opening of Miami Vice is that speedboat race.
Yes.
I mean, that's literally part of the, you know, iconic title sequence of the Miami Vice TV show is this constant speedboat race they keep cutting back to. So, like, I understand why it was there. I guess I also understand why it was cut, though. Yeah. I think I like it better with the speedboat race, personally.
See, so do I. That's why I like the director's cut so much better is that the flourishes that are in it develop both character and relationships, but also have that iconic imagery that the minute you're watching that, you're like, fuck yeah, this is a Miami Vice movie.
But the interesting thing is, and why I think most people are going to not seek out the director's cut, is that it is all relationship stuff. Like, the speedboat chase we're talking about is the closest to an added action sequence in the whole director's cut. There's nothing in the way of an extra shootout. There's nothing in the way of, like, an extra explosion. It is that speedboat race, and then it is all relationship stuff.
Yeah. Well, right after the speedboat race, we have a little more setup setting up the club. Mm-hmm. But yeah, then everything else is all relationships.
Yep.
And in fact, that was one of the big complaints about the theatrical cut was that the relationships seemed underdeveloped. And this cut fixes that.
Yeah, and I mean, that's something that's always been really great about Michael Mann is no matter what, you know, genre he's dabbling in, usually it is, you know, something in the way of a crime thriller, his characters are always really well drawn. And I think, yeah, you do lose a little bit of that in the theatrical cut, but What I like about Michael Mann doing the Miami Vice movie is that when it comes to bad guys, you know, whether it be gangsters, killers, crooks, Mann really likes to have his cake and eat it too. He glamorizes their world in one way or another, and he makes us root for or at least want to be those badass cool outlaws in their fantastic suits. I mean, you look at things like Thief, you look at Heat, you look at Collateral, but then ultimately he highlights the high price paid for their lifestyle every single time.
Yeah.
So he's walking this very interesting moralistic line. And I think why Miami Vice is the most fitting outlet for this particular creative signature is because we get to watch the good guys descend into the sexier world of criminality, but they're the good guys the whole time.
Yeah.
They come out of it and they're still the good guys. So we get to watch the good guys be bad. And we have that attraction to that, like, darker side, but the whole time, they're still good.
Yeah.
They're not perfect, but they're still good.
Yeah. And as a counter to that, the villain in this, not the big villain, but the chief antagonist of this movie, has their number the whole fucking time.
Yeah.
Like, from minute one, he's like, fuck these guys. These guys are cops. And everyone else is like, no, they're not. And we're like, they're, and Crockett and Tubbs are like, no, we're not. And he's like, no, these guys are fucking cops. I don't trust them at all. And he's outguessing them every step of the way, making for a really interesting cat and mouse game because it's not like, oh, are they going to get found out? It's like, they're already found out. This guy just doesn't have the proof. And are they going to fuck up and leave him the proof? But the thing is even though he's right, being right is what leads him into, you know, his own utter destruction. That the choices he makes that he feels are right and are probably the right decision for him turn out being the dead wrong decisions and get him deeper and deeper into hot water in the criminal world.
I just want to throw this out. The bad above that bad, the bad guy who's kind of behind the scenes and in the shadows is played by Luis Tosar, who was terrifying in the supremely excellent 2011 Spanish horror film Sleep Tight. If you haven't seen that already, go watch that. I was actually, I'd forgotten that he was in this, and it was really cool. It was like, oh my god, that's Luis Tosar. I'm even more afraid of him now. If you haven't seen that movie, you don't understand what I'm talking about.
I don't. I haven't seen Sleep
Tight. You haven't seen Sleep Tight, Cargo.
No, I don't know you how should I hadn't see heard Sleep about Tight. Sleep Tight.
Oh, it's by one of the two guys who did Wreck. And it's absolutely fucking phenomenal. So check that out. But yeah, like, I really do like the added relationship stuff. And again, I think this is really kind of the ultimate man film in the way of, or in the regard of that he likes to have that weird moralistic quandary where the audience is rooting for bad guys because they're sexier, but then he definitely pulls the rug out and it becomes a cautionary tale. And I think that's why he created Miami Vice for television in the first place. I think that's what attracted him to do this in the first place. And I feel like it comes full circle when you watch Colin Farrell and Jamie Foxx play Crockett and Tubbs on screen.
Yeah. Yeah. And it really, you know, as much as they are taken in slightly different ways, these guys grab onto these roles and nail it. I love the chemistry between these two. And I love the fact, again, that man doesn't feel the need to create scenes or create backstory that bind these characters together. Instead, they're just bound together and we see their actions together. We don't know how long they've been together, but you can tell immediately that it's been a long fucking time. And you can tell they know each other. And when they chide each other and, like, you know, grab each other and say, you need to cut this shit out, that comes from a real place and a real history. Mm. Like, these guys really, Foxx and Farrell formed a really cohesive bond that really shows and makes this film. There's in the third act, when shit starts getting bad for them, you really feel really hard for these guys and want to see them just kind of cross the line and start kicking the shit out of people.
And, you know, I mentioned that Colin Farrell was a bit of an unusual choice, but do you know who handpicked Colin Farrell to play Sonny Crockett? Don fucking Johnson.
Really?
Michael Mann asked Don Johnson, who do you think should play Sonny Crockett? And he said Colin Farrell. So he was handpicked by the man himself.
Yeah.
So I can't think of any higher praise, any higher endorsement than being picked by the guy who played the fucking role on TV and made it iconic. So yeah. That's pretty remarkable. But yeah, I want to point this out too. As far as the authenticity, I think there's an authenticity in their relationship, and there's also an authenticity in the way that they play undercover cops. And it's because, you know, we've talked about this before. Michael Mann is obsessed with detail. He won't just make a cop movie. He will get into the most finite minutia of what it means to be a cop. Same way with we talked about Thief on a previous episode. I mean, you watch every drill bit, every bead of sweat, every, you know, laser cutter, everything that James Caan uses to open that safe, you feel like you know exactly how that thing works. He's taken it apart very mechanically and shown you every cog and every wheel. And that's exactly, I think, what's going on here with Miami Vice again. So much so, in fact, that he had his actors train with real life law enforcement officers, which isn't surprising. What is surprising is that they observed undercover operations from a safe distance, but then Colin Farrell was told that, you know what, you've learned so much, why don't you participate with us in a real sting operation? So you have Colin Farrell going on a sting operation, during which, and it's caught on video, guns were drawn and the officers' identities were called into question, and Colin Farrell rips his shirt open, just like, doesn't know what else to do, rips his shirt open and starts screaming, I'm not wearing a wire. I'm not a cop, I'm not wearing a wire. And everybody praised him for, like, thinking on the spot. Of course, they told him afterwards this was all staged. He didn't know it was staged. So his reaction was totally real. It's apparently on the DVD extras for this movie that he thought he was involved in a real sting operation. Shit was going wrong. And instead of just, like, crying and being like, I'm an actor, don't kill me, he just rips his shirt open like a badass. Like, I'm not wearing a wire. I'm not a fucking cop.
I'm not a cop.
I'm not a cop.
I'm not a fool. You're a fucking cop.
You're a cop.
You know what? I wish you had told me that story beforehand, because I just realized what we needed to do to make this a double episode.
What's that?
We needed to talk about The Hard Way.
We could have done a double episode with The Hard Way. We will do it. We'll give The Hard Way its own episode.
No, but going back to what you're talking about, that's one of the interesting things about this movie is the minutiae they go into, including the bureaucracy. Like, there is an amazing series of scenes with one of my favorite unsung character actors, who's finally starting to get his play because he showed up on Game of Thrones, Kieran Hines, who's playing, you know, a cop from a different agency.
Agent Fujiyama.
Yeah, and he...
Fujima, sorry.
He's involved in an operation that that brought John Hawke's character into play, and now Crockett and Tubbs are kind of crossing the streams, if you will, and they have to navigate this guy and deal with all the interagency bullshit to get this operation done, to get this guy who did this.
You know, with the amount of long-standing homoerotic sexual tension between Crockett and Tubbs, I really wish you hadn't gone with crossing the streams as your turn of phrase, but I guess
we're junk food cinema, and everybody knew what I meant without going for the
oh really? The wait. Are you saying we're highbrow? Like, wait, when did that happen? Because I'm not comfortable highbrow. With that. I am not comfortable with that at
all. I said dropping a Ghostbusters reference without mentioning that it's a Ghostbusters reference kind of, you know, hit the buttons of everybody listening to this right now.
And you all remember that. Yeah, and there's another interesting thing that happened in this movie as far as the long-standing effects is that Jamie Foxx, who asked for more money to be in this movie, also does not film outside of the United States anymore because of this movie.
Really?
Yeah, apparently they were filming... So they were filming in the Dominican Republic in October 2005, and then there was a public shooting, like, right as they were filming, and Jamie Foxx left the country, refused to ever film outside of the United States again, so Michael Mann had to change the original ending, which was to be filmed in Paraguay. That's why the ending of this movie is like, Crockett walking into the hospital and not what they had intended, because they were going to shoot it in Paraguay, and it was like, well, Jamie Foxx won't shoot out of the States anymore because he's terrified. Which is funny when you consider the story I just told about Colin Farrell and how Colin Farrell held up when there was a gun in his face. I don't know. I don't know what it is about this movie. The theatrical cut, to a certain extent, the relationships aren't quite there. But I don't know what it is about the movie overall that I don't have quite as much reverence for it as you do. But it just, it doesn't... Doesn't quite get me. Doesn't quite get there.
Yeah, I don't. I think the fact that it's not particularly a fun movie, like it's not. A lot of the films we talk about are fun. You know, they're just like we were talking about Bad Boys 2 a little while ago, which you were profaning.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like I don't need the movie to be fun, like necessarily. Yeah. It's just something. But I don't know.
Yeah, no, but it's just it's such a cool experiment, and maybe the experiment just doesn't work as well with you. I mean, I look at it, and I think it's a marvel of storytelling in just how lean they are about everything. And when you actually sit down and try to break down the plot of it, there's a lot of stuff you have to explain that isn't over-explained in the movie. And it's got some incredibly tense action scenes. It's got some incredibly brutal moments. It's got some great kills.
Oh, it's got some fantastic kills.
There's just so much stuff that goes on in this film that's just so fucking cool that I just really, really enjoy it and marvel at the fact that you're jumping into a speedboat that's already going full speed and it never slows down and it's just all the way to the end. And especially the director's cut. The director's cut is what, like upwards of 2.5 hours.
I was going to say lean is not necessarily the word I would use to describe a movie.
It's lean in storytelling.
It's 2 hours and 20 minutes long all when all is said and done. But one of the interesting carryovers from the show that I think speaks to what you're talking about with the kills is that there was this weird thing in the show where Rico goes ape shit when somebody pisses him off. Like, or if somebody points a machine gun at him. He claims to hate machine guns, but whenever he has one in his hand, everyone in the room is going to fucking die. But if you piss off Rico Tubbs in the show, lots of people are going to get dead. And in this, there's a point in this movie where it's a hostage situation where he's already wounded one of the guys, and the guy is crawling away from him. and he shoots him in the back of the head. And I remember being like, what the fuck?
Oh, yeah.
I don't think that's procedure.
No, that's one of the things I dig about this, is the fact is these are not superhero cops. There are a lot of things that you can call these cops on and be like, that is a corrupt fucking cop. And the only reason you're with these guys is their corruption has nothing to do
with personal gain.
With personal gain. It has everything to do with protecting the public, or, you know, them crossing the line in a moment of passion, which is what I think is really... gets to the heart of reality that man likes to do, is he's saying, look, these cops are good guys, but that doesn't mean they always do the right thing. And that murky gray area is not glorified in this movie. When he does that, you're not supposed to go, fuck yeah. Like, there's one kill in the movie where you're like, fuck yeah, and you're supposed to be fuck yeah. And that's where there's that hostage situation. And
you won't even twitch.
And then bam, and you're just like, full.
Which by the way is another carryover from the show. There's an episode where somebody puts a gun to a female hostage's head, and I think it's Sonny who says, he says like, one twitch and she's dead, and he goes, that's fine, you won't even twitch, and then shoots him like through the neck. So I mean, even that moment.
But this moment in particular is like, I'm gonna count to three. One, cap.
Yeah.
It was just like, fuck yes.
And done. Over.
Yeah, no, that's that scene in particular, that scene's so great and tense, because at that point you're so wound up and angry about what's happening. Like, it's a total bully thing where you just, all these people involved are just the shittiest of shitty people, and you're like, I wanna see every one of these motherfuckers get capped. Even the teenage kid I want to see get capped. Fuck these people. And you are just, you're in it. And that last half an hour is just so badass and brutal. And then the final shootout, oh my God.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a clusterfuck, and it's so fucking good. And
it's messy, but not in the way that it's shot. It's messy in the operation that running.
Yeah, no, I mean, everything goes wrong and it turns into a bloody shootout the way it's not supposed to go down. And nothing goes to plan. There's no moment where everything kind of comes together at the end and they're like, ha ha ha, just as we planned it. And,
yeah, it's the anti-Hannibal Smith approach.
Yeah.
There's nothing, the plan never comes together.
Yeah, no, it's them constantly readjusting the plan to changes, and changes that get fucked up, and things that go down that they just can't deal with. And now, that's not to say that they do everything wrong. They do everything right to adjust to it, but it is not about letting the villains fall into their carefully laid trap. It's about the villains being a step ahead of them every bit of the way, and them having to catch up and deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a fascinating storytelling structure. I love how these guys are always playing catch up with the villains, and it makes it feel real and raw, and understand why these criminals are as powerful as they are. You know, that's one of those things that we ignore a lot in films, is, you know, you've got the evil mastermind who will execute his own henchmen and who's terrifying and feeds people to tigers and all this ridiculous shit. You're just like, how the fuck did this guy ever become one of the most powerful people on the planet and need James Bond to take him down? Yeah, these guys, they're smart, you know, they make good decisions, they make sound decisions. You understand why their employees work for them. They, you know, they give their employees a little leeway, they give them some breathing room, they trust them to make their own decisions. And it's really an interesting real world kind of dynamic. It's like, okay, yeah, that drug lord is powerful and scary, but also very personable to his employees, and is just like a good boss. So if that guy paid a lot of money, yeah, I might break the law for that guy. Like that, you know, so the attraction is there. And it's really interesting how that's all kind of fleshed out. And I really like the world that it immerses me in. It feels like it has a bit of authenticity to it.
Yeah, there was a... The other weird thing about the director's cut is that it goes so far to expound upon the relationship of Sonny and the boss's lady. They have so many fucking sex scenes in that 2 hour and 20 minutes that I was like, I can kind of understand why. Because it really does get to the point where it feels like one of those episodes where, like, there's like an episode where Crockett falls in love with Sheena Easton, you know, on the show, and it was like, yeah, this seems a little drawn out. So I think that adding to the relationship is good. I think at a certain point it's just overkill, and I think that relationship to me was just like, okay, yeah, then you're doing that again. Like I get it. Like you don't need to sell me on it. Like.
Are you telling me that
stop drilling? You've hit oil. Literally, stop drilling. You've hit oil. I understand the context of this relationship, and you're just adding to the runtime by adding sex scene after sex scene after sex scene.
Yes and no. That was, you know, the theatrical cut. When I watched the theatrical cut, the only scene I didn't like was the shower scene, the shower sex scene. In the extended cut, there is a lot of additional sex scenes. Or seemingly a lot of additional time for sex scenes. But that's where a lot of the character development for those two people are.
See, I vehemently disagree with that.
That's where I feel they kind of expound upon the emotion of them so that the third act, you have that punch. I think that's what a lot of people felt lacked in the theatrical originally.
I really like that you... The emotional punch is there from the first time that happens, and everything that's added to their relationship is in conversation. There's nothing in the second or third sex scene that adds anything that wasn't established either in a conversation scene or in the first sex scene. I don't see that. I don't see it at all.
I get it, except I feel that it deepens it. That it just did the, you know, that's, it's always been one of my pet peeves that I write off. You know, everybody has the cinematic pet peeves they write off. And for me, a cinematic pet peeve I just have never liked is, hey, I find you attractive. Hey, I find you attractive. This writer is developing our relationship. Let's have sex once, and now we are bound together and we'll die for one another. Like, so many heroes and heroines have one-night stands that bind them together, and what man does here is, this is not a one-night stand. This is not two people who are attracted to each other, get their rocks off, and then go off to continue working with each other. This is two people who keep having a relationship that both of them know they shouldn't be having. And every time they do it, puts them deeper and deeper in danger, but they can't stop themselves. And I find that interesting.
Yeah, but I feel like you could communicate that so many different ways without just like piling sex in. At a certain point, sure. I just feel like it becomes steamy for steamy's sake. It's like you could, all the things you talked about, you could easily establish through their conversations, which they do. And so to add that on top of it is just like, and again, I just think it's a little bit overkill. But again, like I understand what man is trying to do, and I appreciate that. But I just, that's one of the things about the director's cut that doesn't quite work for me. But then again, it's not, I don't really favor the theatrical either. So I don't know. I guess I'm the one trying to have his cake and eat it too. But still, this movie, if you haven't seen it, I would recommend watching the director's cut over the theatrical cut for a number of different reasons.
Yeah, whether you like it, whether you love it, it's hard to argue against the fact that it is man's last really good movie.
That is very unfortunately true.
Yeah, he's had a, you know, the last 10 years have not been kind to Michael Mann.
No, culminating with unfortunately Black Hat, which I was so looking forward to, and I just hoped beyond hope that it would be the movie that kind of rejuvenated him. But I mean, like after this is just Public Enemies and Black Hat. Like he only made two movies in that time period.
And
I mean,
both are bad.
Both are bad. And prior to this, he had Collateral, which I think is another of his completely...
It's
not unsung. It's not unsung, but man, people do not appreciate that movie on the level it should really be appreciated.
You know, here's a point that I wanted to bring up that we haven't discussed yet. One of the interesting things about this movie and Collateral was they were shot on HD, and they were the first two major blockbusters to be shot on HD. And that was something that bothered the shit out of all of us when it happened. And I remember one of the big critic arguments when this came out, and one of the problems that bugged me a little bit, was that people were like, I don't understand why he shot in HD. The guy shoots beautiful film. Why is he shooting on HD? And my aunt's like, it's the future of cinema. You don't understand. And people are like, no. The future of cinema is film, not HD. The future of indie cinema may be HD, but no, it's not the future. And then you go back and rewatch this, and you rewatch it on Blu-ray, and you see it in all of its HD glory. And you don't even fucking notice it. There's one shot in here that has the old HD graininess at night, which was one of the problems with early cameras, and that some cameras still have. Stuff that you don't necessarily get on the Alexa in Red these days.
Which, by the way, is a weird thing to criticize for Michael Mann. Oh, your night shots are a little grainy. I'm like, that's like that. That to me is Michael Mann. Like the night shots are supposed to be grainy.
But you go
he's got so much grit in his stories that it comes up off the ground and into the atmosphere for fuck's sake.
But the thing is you remember these movies as being these HD films, you know, and then you go back and watch it and he shot HD like fucking cinema and it's great fucking HD. And you watch that shit on your HD television and holy God, do these movies hold up looking great. Mm-hmm. And man, for someone playing around with the dawn of technology, man fucking nailed it. Like he nailed it. And you don't even notice, you forget about it. And because you've watched by this point, you know, you and I have probably watched 2000 films in HD at this point of our lives, you know, considering how many festivals we go to and how many indies we watch. I had completely forgotten that it was shot in HD until the end. And I was like, holy fuck, I forgot about that. Mm-hmm. And it was such a cool, it's such a cool experience going back and rewatching it. And Collateral holds up the same way. Collateral was, I think, a generation back of camera, so it's not as good as the Miami Vice camera. But still, you don't really pay attention to it. You're used to seeing orange halogen lights in film and watching the way that it colors everyone and seeing a bit of graininess here and there. And that's something we've become accustomed to. And I think these films have aged well for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. And I always really enjoy the way that Michael Mann films look. I think he was one of those pioneers and one of those guys that was really unpopular in the way that he pioneered, but really stuck it out and created a signature look that I don't think gets enough praise. And yeah, I like Miami Vice. I think a lot of why I like Miami Vice is just in how Mann focuses on details and how he's allowed to play with some of the thematic stuff that typifies his movies I really love, things like Thief and Heat and Collateral, and really kind of bring those into, you know, it's this very fitting sort of full circle thing where the guy started is where his last good movie ends up. You know, they begin and end in the same place. They begin and end with Miami Vice. And I think that's a really kind of beautiful circle that he's completed. I wish that he could find that spark again. But if he doesn't, it is kind of apropos that his career has this beautiful like circle to it. And, you know, I appreciate that. I do want to talk about the movie that almost was, because let's neither Colin Farrell nor Jamie Foxx were the first choices for their roles necessarily. For example, the Tom Cruise, Brad Pitt and Matthew McConaughey were all considered for the role of Detective Sonny Crockett. On the other
side, one of them would actually go on to become one of the true detectives and resuscitate his own career.
There you go. Solve the mystery of his missing appeal. And then there was the fact that Will Smith, Denzel Washington and Samuel L. Jackson were all considered for Rico Tubbs. So think about those six people for a second. And really, like, really just
like as oddball as that is, it could have been slightly odder.
Okay, but think about it and tell me if there is any combination of those six people that could have possibly worked. Any combination of those six guys.
Yes.
Could any of those have worked?
Yes.
Okay, which one?
I'd love to see a Brad Pitt, Samuel L. Jackson, Crockett and Tubbs. I mean, that would just be kind of amazing. No, honestly, I think Brad Pitt and Will Smith would have made a really great movie.
See, I was actually
they're
thinking McConaughey and Will
Smith. Actors.
Yeah,
they're both really good, especially at this point. At this point in both of their careers, they were both doing kind of gritty character immersion. Like right now, Will Smith is doing more of the big kind of blockbustery stuff and doing much more of the fun stuff.
But isn't this also when Will Smith did like Pursuit of Happiness? Wasn't that around 2006?
Yeah. And, in this era, it's that, and it's, I Am Legend, like big character immersion stuff where he's like, no, I'm not playing Will Smith action star. I'm playing a character.
Yeah.
And so watching that Will Smith dive into this role, he'd kind of gotten away from Bad Boys. You know, he'd been okay. I've made the big blockbusters. Now I want to be seen as an actor. And then of course, Brad Pitt is always, as we've talked about, you know, many times, Brad Pitt is always, you know, a great gritty deep in it actor, and watching him do something different than what he did in Seven, where he could actually play with his charisma and play that kind of sexy bad boy. I think that could have worked. It would have been a very different movie. It would have had to have been a bigger movie. It would have had more studio meddling for sure.
Yeah.
Because the studio would have come in and gone, you're making a Brad Pitt, Will Smith movie, and you're not explaining who the characters are. No, you need some exposition in the first 10 minutes of the movie.
See, but this would have been the perfect time to do it, because I just looked this up. In 2006, both Brad Pitt and Will Smith only made one movie each. Will Smith made Pursuit of Happiness, and Brad Pitt made Babel. If there was ever going to be a year where the two of those guys decided to step slightly out of their wheelhouse and do something gritty and different, it would have been 2006.
Yeah.
That's the year, like, two of their most outlying movies, you know, respectively, were released. So that could have been interesting. I also kind of like the idea of a Matthew McConaughey, Will Smith, Miami Vice. I would have watched the shit out of that. I really would have. Although that was prior to the McConaissance, so that would have felt gamble.
This was smack dab in the middle of his ready to launch,
Launch.
Yeah, the failure to launch.
Don't forget the word failure when we're talking about Matthew McConaughey's
career. Yeah, the failure to launch
point.
Area, the era when he was driving around in his Airstream, high as a kite, making romantic comedies with posters where he couldn't stand up straight. And all of those things are true and not exaggerations. Go look at the posters from that era. No,
it's like my legs don't work, man. It's weird.
Yeah, no, and he needed that era in order to kick him in the ass to get where he is now, which is we got back the guy that we had early on.
The closest we got to something gritty and real from McConaughey in 2006 is We Are Marshall. So do with that what you will, guys.
Was We Are Marshall 2006?
It was. Both We Are Marshall and Failure to Launch were 2006. So that was the 1-2 punch of McConaughey we got that year. But maybe it could have started sooner. Maybe we could have kicked off the McConaissance a little early.
But had that happened, people would not have wanted him for True Detective. Because he'd already played that role. That was the whole thing about True Detective, was they took two guys and kind of played them against type and got an amazing show. If you've never seen True Detective and you're a Miami Vice fan, it is these things are two great tastes that taste great together. They are very similar in their treatment of police procedure and in character. In fact, I believe very much so that True Detective would not exist if it were not for Michael Mann's movies.
And speaking of movies that almost were, did you know that both Edward James Olmos and Jan Hammer were asked to come back and be a part of this 2006 film adaptation, and both of them declined?
Why did Edward James Olmos turn?
I don't know. He was given a chance to. He was going to come back as Castillo. He was going to be the captain. Like, it was just going to come back and play that role again. But he didn't want to do it, and that makes me so sad. Oh, he was so great.
Well, he did
role.
Have a show at the time.
Was he doing Battlestar at that time?
He was
time?
Doing Battlestar okay. in 2006.
Yeah, maybe. But Jan Hammer was asked to come back and do a completely different type of score. Basically given carte blanche, like, you do what you want. Do a new version. Do whatever you think modernizes it a little bit. And he wouldn't do it.
I get that. I really get that. Considering that's the score he's best known for, and that's kind of the joke, going back to that well was probably something
but
he wanted
a,
to avoid.
What a great chance to reinvent that and take it back.
I agree, but I get it. I get not going back to the well. Yeah. I mean, the fact that man went back to the well was, you know, a big deal. But you can't expect everyone to want to go back to that well. And it's entirely possible that those people had bad experiences working with man. You know, maybe they didn't like, ultimately, over the years, did not develop a great relationship with man. And they were like, yeah, I don't know if I want to come back and work with Mike.
Well, let's talk about one more thing. How do you feel about the non-point, just in general, like, take it out of this movie. How do you feel about the non-point cover of In the Air Tonight?
I think it's interesting. I mean, it's In the Air Tonight is just one of those iconic 80s songs. Like, if you were to make a list of the 10 greatest, most iconic 80s songs, that would be up there. Like, it's a tie between that and Against All Odds for Phil Collins' most iconic song of the 80s. It's that drum beat in particular. If you go, just play around with it sometime. Just go, and see how many people around you going, I can feel it coming in the air tonight. And that cover was cool. When I heard it, I was like, hey, that's a great cover. It does something a little different, but it captures what I like about the song. And it's definitely a great reference to the old show. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's not a great enough song that it's like, I need to go down and get that off iTunes and have that on my phone. Because, no, it's just a good cut. If I'm going to have something on my phone, I'm going to have the Phil Collins.
Have the original. Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that the cover song does that I think is funny and kind of poignant when you're talking about a remake, and or not even a remake, but like a nouveau version of something and how you modernize things, is that drum solo happens like 3 times.
Yes.
In the non-point version. It's not saved for that one perfect moment. It's like, yeah, we're going to shoot our wad all over this song.
Yeah.
All over this song.
Well, that's the iconic thing about that song. Like, that moment right there. I actually have that bookmarked on that exact moment. I have that bookmarked on my computer for when the need arises, and every once in a while I tweet or text friends just the drum break. And
you're a weird lady. I just want you to know.
I am one weird lady.
And you're a weird lady. So whether you watch the original version, whether you watch the director's cut, if you haven't seen Miami Vice, watch the last good Michael Mann film. I feel like it sounds like I'm disparaging the guy, but I really like...
Black Cat was such a disappointment.
It really was.
It's like, had that been directed by a mid-lister or, a first-timer, it would just be easy to dismiss. But being Michael Mann and seeing the talent that he accrued in that movie and seeing how much of it was wasted and that nonsensical final action sequence... where it's like, we're going to have a shootout in the middle of a parade and nobody's going to pay any attention. And there might be some context to why they're not paying attention. Mm. But when you have a shootout in between marching people and nobody even ducks,
yeah,
it just really, kind of takes you out of it as an audience. And you're just like, this is just, what happened, dude? What happened?
I still think the biggest problem with that movie is that Michael Mann finally reached a point where he was so detail-oriented that he couldn't see the woods for all the trees. Because we spend so much time with, like, the really, 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 really fine points of, computer hacking that it's just like, okay, but what about the story, man? We saw hackers, okay? We know how the internet works, all right? So just focus
on
the story.
Let's be fair, not everybody has seen Hackers.
Everyone should see Hackers.
Everyone should see Hackers.
That's what you should take away from this episode, guys. And that brings us, of course, to the junk food pairing, which for this one I have chosen an ice-cold mojito. How far would you go for the perfect mojito? For Sonny Crockett, he not only would go to Cuba, he would go deeper into his cover, and he would go deeper into, the boss's lady. But the point is, sometimes when you want that perfect combination of rum and sugar and mint, there's no lengths to which you won't go. And a great cocktail, much like a movie featured on Junk Food Cinema, is going to combine some elements that you might think, when you look at them all separately, would never go well together. But sure enough, they do form something very refreshing. And also, whether you're watching the director's cut or whether you're watching the theatrical cut, is basically like whether you're getting a drink at the bar or made at home by somebody who's a little bit more experimental. So basically what I'm saying is, get real drunk and watch both versions of Miami Vice. I think I lost the thread of what I was talking about there halfway through, but still, mojito, this week's junk food pairing. Thank you so much for joining us on this episode. I hope you've enjoyed it. We'll be back next week with another random movie for Random Movie May. You can find us on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, and you can like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. Cargo, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me at facebook.com/massaworm. That's MASSAWIRM. Or on Twitter at massaworm.
Awesome. You can find me on Facebook, facebook.com/BrianSalisburyCritic, or on Twitter at BriGuySalisbury. And you can also find me over at oneofus.net, my home away from home. A lot of great geek podcasts and blogs over there. And hey, we're going to have a link up to purchase the director's cut of Miami Vice. So if you would, or yeah, you can purchase it, right? Okay. I watched it on Amazon, but yeah. I think you can purchase it as a Blu-ray. And if you'd like to do that, why not come here first, click on it, buy it. Doesn't add any charge.
Smack it
for
up,
you.
Flip it, rub it down. Oh no.
Yeah, yeah. Do all of those things. It won't cost you anything extra, and it supports the show, and we really do appreciate that. So join us next week, because next week we'll be back. Back to take over the globe. Now break bread.
Boeing jets, Global Express, out the country, but the blueberry still connect. On the low, but the yacht got a triple deck. But when you young, what the you expect? Yep. Grand opening, grand closing. Damn your manhole, crack the can open again. Who you gonna find? Dope?